I am now very grateful to introduce our main speaker for tonight. Her name is Beth. Will you please give her a round of applause and welcome her?
Hi, I'm Beth. I am a grateful, recovering person from alcoholism, the effects of alcoholism and dysfunction. And I'm not quite happy to be here yet. I've got the... reminds me of how I used to be so detached from my body, you know, just thinking all the time. And then I learned to connect, and so, you know, you got to shake off some of that stuff that when you get overwhelmed, just shake it off. You guys must be serious about this. I mean, Saturday night, it's hot, so really, congratulations. And I was one of those people who didn't have, well, like active alcoholism in my home growing up. My great-grandfather was shot in a saloon, and he was killed. This is how the story comes down. And so after that, it went undercover. Like, everyone became Presbyterian and scary stuff back then. And no, we don't know. You know, you didn't know. You just didn't drink. And if you did, you better not let anybody find out. So there was a moratorium on alcohol. But the ism sure did, you know. We inherited the ism, and it didn't get any lighter as the generations came down. In fact, you know, when you suppress something, it usually gets worse. So by the time I was born in Los Angeles, you know, my dad was a teetotaler, because he was from that side of the family that didn't drink. And he was an atheist, and he claimed to be a communist, and he was a mathematician. And I wanted love from him. I wanted to be loved and valued from this man, you know, my daddy. And he just wasn't capable of that. So, but I didn't know that. So, and then my, and he was, his ism, the way his ism came through was that he was intolerant of anything that was out of order. And so we were very obedient children. I was a very obedient child. And that's the best I could do to get his love and affection, you know, by being obedient. And I just was as obedient as I could possibly be, which was pretty stifling, you know. And so it was very oppressed. I was raised in an oppressive environment. My mother was an enabler of him, because she didn't protect us from his violent episodes. He would punish us if we stepped out of line, and it was severe. Like, as just, I remember being a tiny person and getting, well, it started out getting thumped. Has anybody here ever been thumped? You know what I'm talking about, thumped? Like this big old thump? And your brains are like... So it just started out that way. And then there were just a lot of times when he couldn't tolerate behavior that was out of line, and he made sure we were punished. I think my brother got it worse than I did. My brother was 4 years older, and I think my dad was jealous also. He married a younger woman, and I think he was jealous of us children. His mom, she was a mother, you know, so she gave us attention. But she couldn't protect us, so she was impotent to protect us from his rages and his intolerance. So, so I had some saving graces in my childhood. I had a teddy bear called Fuzzy. Seriously, he was real, right? a real teddy bear who I adored, and he was a companion. And I would leave home a lot, like get up early in the morning and just take out the back door on 3rd Avenue in Los Angeles and with Fuzzy and maybe a box of raisins and an apple or something, and I'd head out. And then I would start walking, just walking forward, you know, just leaving that place. Although I didn't consciously know that I was leaving that place. But then I'd keep going until I was lost. Oftentimes I would be lost. And I remember just going up, when I realized I was lost, I would go up to a house and just knock on the door and say, I'm lost. And they would say, well, who are your parents? This was back in the day, you know. And they would call my parents, and they would come and get me. And I think they behaved well for a while after that. You know, like each time I don't think I called it running away. I just left. So that was a saving grace for me, that I was able to just leave on my own. And then also there was a woman who lived in the garage next door. Her name was Mary, and she was a dwarf, like a little person, not too little, but she was my buddy. You know, she did the ironing for everyone in the neighborhood. She ironed everybody's clothes. Well, not everybody's, but she certainly ironed our clothes. Because my mom was a legal secretary, and she went to work downtown LA every day. And Dad went, you know, to teach. He was a high school teacher. So Mary would say things like, "How's that crazy family of yours?" And it was like, wow, Mary, really? You know, I think there was something wrong with her, because we were perfect. We were like a perfect family. And so a lot of this unconscious behavior, I think we all, hopefully we all have it, that we do to take care of ourselves. Like John Bradshaw, you know John Bradshaw, they call him the good father, when I was in ACA years ago. And he wrote a book called Championing the Inner Child. And he talked about what heroes we are as children to get through what we got through. You know, so if you're here and you're recovering, you know, you could just look in the mirror when you get home and thank that kid, that amazing child that got you through. I do that. I do mirror work. I had to do mirror before I came here tonight. I told that girl in the glass, I said, you know, it's okay to be nervous. It's okay to feel vulnerable. Just tell the truth, and you're going to be okay. So try to do that. So all this oppression and then the beatings, and I ended up, you know, dissociating. Because I could. Children can do that. Apparently adults can't learn it. You have to learn it in childhood. So off I went, you know, who knows how high up, when I was getting hurt. And then also, as I grew older, not having a sense of self, because I was obedient. So all I knew was following the rules. I really had no sense of self. I would make stuff up. My mother actually was an actress. So she kind of, I never really got who she was. She acted. I think she acted like a mother, even. She was good. But when I started going to meetings and hearing women tell the truth, you know, about themselves and talk about their own vulnerability and just feelings, what they were feelings, and crying. That to me was, I mean, that was like taking a drink. I needed that so badly. I needed my mother to be real. And I needed, you know, my dad to be capable of loving me. I think he did the best he can. I think my parents did the best they could. And I don't like to blame, because every time I get into that, I just make a victim of myself. I don't like being a victim. That's a nowhere street, you know. I mean, holding our parents accountable is one thing, but wallowing in that, you know, is not a good idea. So, So then as I grew up, you know, I didn't have self-esteem. I had other esteem, what they call other esteem. So whatever you wanted me to be, I'm going to be a good, and then I'm going to have that esteem for a while. And then, you know, when that wore off, I'd get other esteem. And I didn't have a lot of boyfriends in high school. I don't know if it's because I was tall or because my dad taught there. Or, I don't know. But I didn't. It's a good thing, probably, that I didn't. Because, you know, I was really needy. So it's probably good, or maybe they, you know, these guys were smart not to come around this sick gal. But so I got, as time went on, you know, I just got so crazy. And since I was dissociated and I had the PTSD, I didn't care about getting hurt. And I wanted to, I just liked doing exciting things to get some kind of feeling, probably, because I was so shut down, right? So I would do dangerous things, and I would try to talk to my girlfriend. I would always say, let's just do it. No one's going to know in 100 years. I remember saying that to her. And she, you know, she didn't really want to do these dangerous things that I wanted to do. So then this whole thing of other esteem and reacting from that, you know, like I would get a job and then I would have that identity. And then I had no tools to communicate or ask to get my needs met or all the tools we learn in ACA. I didn't have any of those. So when the time came, and it always came, there was some conflict, I was out of there. I would leave before they even knew it, you know. So I pretty much, my resume is very long. I have lots and lots of jobs on my resume. And when I went to college, I couldn't stay in college. I think, I don't know, I was so not interested in it. The institution of it. And it just seemed like a huge father. You know, like I would have to do well or else. And I was older now, you know, I don't want any more of that. There's something pulling me in other directions. But I did try. I tried for a couple of years, and then I discovered alcohol. And I, you know, I told you about the family, how there was a moratorium on drinking. I took that drink for all of them. Yeah. And it worked. It worked for me. It worked. It just worked. I don't know how else to say it. It was just magnificent. It was the best elixir of anything I could imagine. And I drank. But I don't know that I drank alcoholically yet. Because after I left college, oh yeah, I know what happened. No, this is a good reaction story. I met, there was a man in the boys' dorm that wanted to go out with me. And I actually liked his roommate. But the roommate didn't like me. So I was flunking out of college. So this guy asked me to marry him. Perfect. So I'm going to save face, you know, because I didn't get my bachelor's, but I got my MRS. Like, what? Right? That's what we do. People will say, well, what happened to Beth? Why is she not in classes? Oh, she got married. Oh, Beth got married, you know. So, for a year and a half, I was married. Hey. I woke up one morning, and he wasn't a bad guy. I mean, but I said, Tom, I said, I can't do this marriage thing anymore. I just can't do it. It's not you. You know, I said, I got to go back to L.A. We were living in Hesperia. And he was kind of dumbfounded, but that's what I did. I got in the car and packed up a few things and went back to L.A. Well, that was a kind of... the drinking accelerated. I was a mean drunk, because I had a lot to get out. And I didn't care who I hurt. It was, for me, it was an absolute catharsis, you know, absolute. And I'm surprised I didn't get hurt more than I did out there. But I had protectors, you know, I had some men who protected me out there. And then I actually, let's see, how did it work? I moved in with a man, and about 10 months into our relationship, he said, "Shouldn't we be married?" And I said, "Yeah, you know, you're asking me to marry you." He says, "Yeah." So I married this man because, again, reacting, always reacting, because I was getting older, and all my friends were married, my girlfriends were married, and I you know, I got to get married too. So this poor guy, you know, I'm a user. You know, I was a user. Users use. We react and we use. And I'm this whirling dervish, just reacting and using and just surviving and trying to, I don't know what I was, just staying alive, basically. So I married this man, and, you know, we neither one had any of those, we shouldn't have been married, but we had a child because I thought that was going to fix the marriage. I didn't want to be divorced again, so I got pregnant, and, I thought it would fix the marriage, and of course it doesn't. And so we both were raging alcoholics, this man and I, and then we raised a daughter in a war zone. In a war zone she was raised. She, part of my amends to her was telling her about ACA. So, you know, you go there, you won't be alone anymore. You won't feel alone in your stuff. So she did. She went to ACA. This is years later, you know, after I got sober. So I got sober, and then I was amazed and grateful like crazy that the obsession to drink lifted off of me. And then for a year, I was, you know, I didn't drink because it was lifted, and I was happy to be in AA and going to meetings. But people would talk about happy, joyous, and free. You know, I wasn't like really happy, joyous, and free, not like that. And then, of course, somebody mentioned ACA. There's a meeting in the same clubhouse. You know, why don't you try it out? So this was back in 1991. And, you know, Tony, is it Tony R?
He's
A. Tony A. Started ACA in New York in 1987. And it came out to Los Angeles in 1985. That's what your brochure says out there. You can get a brochure on a little history. And so ACA had only been around a while. We didn't have workbooks. That's a fabulous workbook. I'm so impressed now with the meetings that are going on, what we have, and the big book. It scares me, I gotta tell you. At the beginning, it's like really big. It looks like, it looks academic to me. So I haven't done much with it. But the work, and so, so I start going to ACA, but I couldn't say anything. You know, I sat in the meetings. They were real different from AA. There were like something going on there, deep, deep healing stuff. And I couldn't say anything, and I just listened. And I don't know how many meetings I went to until one day they had a speaker. And I was listening to her talk. I don't know what she said. But all of a sudden, the floodgates opened, and I began to weep like never before or since, really. And it seemed pre-verbal. I can't tell you what I was thinking or feeling. It could have been pre-verbal, you know, a lot of stuff way back there. So that was, you know, the beginning of my recovery in ACA. And then just going to those meetings. And mostly I went with women because, you know, I was scared of men. And I would censor myself around men. So I didn't belong in meetings with men at that time. Now that I hear men like Ken share, you know, they're safe. I know what the safe men are. There are safe men, and I'm quite happy about that. They're not all, you know, like my dad. So in ACA, we just had each other. We didn't have those books that you guys have. We didn't have pamphlets, but we had each other, and that's the basis of these programs, right? connecting with somebody that has the same pain. And there's a healing that comes out of that. It's like magic. And so these women, they would bring in literature from outside. Like, we read a lot of Marianne Williamson and Pia Melody. You know, Pia Melody talked a lot about love addiction. She still does. She wrote about love addiction and how, you know, what makes a love addict is that people, we get a little love. Like somebody like me, I got a little love growing up, a little love, but not enough, right? So I chased that my whole life. And I would go to the same person, like Ken said, we go to the same person to get the rest of that love that we think we need. And that's exhausting and painful. It's called going to the dry well for water. Keep going back to the dry well for water. Keep going to the hardware store for milk. Sell me some milk, damn it. We don't carry milk here. We carry tools. But I would insist. And the men in my life, I had to give amends to a couple of them because I insisted that they give me something and I punished them for not giving me what I thought I needed. So that was part of my amends in ACA. So then in our group, our women back in Agoura, because that's where I started ACA, we would say things like, well, let's make up mothers. Let's create a mother for ourselves. We can make one up. Like, just pick out a characteristics and, like, somebody that you admire and create a mother for yourself, right? It was like the first step in me becoming the woman I always wanted to be with. I always wanted to be with a mother who protected me and who loved and valued me. So that was the first step. And I don't know if you guys ever see this film, How Green Was My Valley? Anyway, it's an old film. But Maureen O'Hara is a woman in that film, and she's an Irish woman. And yeah. I just loved the kind of mother she was, so I picked her. I picked Maureen O'Hara to start my inner mother by. And gosh, you know, I don't know if I ever created an inner father. Maybe that's the work I need to do next. And then, of course, the body work. There was an ACA. We danced a lot in the meeting. You know, we get up and move our bodies and dance and release a lot of that energy, the negative energy. And it was pretty kind of not too organized, but it worked. And then, the mirror work. So eventually I had to do that mirror work that we all need to do, or at least I can't assume that you need to do it, but I had to grieve the fantasy that there was somebody out there in the world that would make me feel loved and valued. I had to grieve that. And that was a big fantasy, you know, like the Cinderella syndrome. It was I was counting on that. That was always in the back of my mind and heart, that he'll show up, you know, he'll show up. And then I guess it came just at the right time, because I was able to grieve that fantasy. And it was pretty bad, to that grief, you know, because it was like, they say around here, if it doesn't feel like dying, you're not doing it right. And that felt like dying. It's dying, now what, you know? All I had was me. But apparently I had enough of me that I could let go of that fantasy. So then I was going to the mirror and saying, we were told we were to say, look right in the eyes, you know, you gotta look at your eyes, you gotta say it out loud, you have to say, I love you, I really love you, and I promise I'll never abandon you, ever. And you have to say it again, three times, like do this for 2 weeks, and the first time I couldn't even get, you know, forget about it. I couldn't do a full-on thing the first time. I just started breaking down crying, because I knew what that meant. That meant I was breaking up with the fantasy. So I couldn't do it for a while. But it came, you know, it comes if you're willing. And of course, we have higher powers. We have a higher power. I had a higher power that was just like, just so much like Ken talked about, that warm support that's just always there when we are aware of that, you know, when we have that conscious contact. So that higher power would get me to the mirror pretty often. And I, if you can do it, you know, like if only, if maybe you just run by the mirror and just say hi. Maybe just do that. Just to start. That's all you can do to start. That's okay, that's a start. So, you know, what it's like now, well, I go to a lot of meetings for a while there because I discovered this fabulous 12-step family. I was going to I went to five meetings, different 12-step programs in a week. I was totally immersed. We'd go to retreats and workshops in the beginning. Anything, that's all it was about. Just thirsted for recovery, you know, thirsted to be real. I want to be real. And I thought I had a shot at it because I heard other women broken down more than I were, and they became real. So I went to, you know, like AA, and then, oh, smoking. I forgot to say about smoking. That's when I had to stop smoking before I could do the inner child work, because the smoke screen, the child was behind that smoke screen. So that was a big component. I forgot to mention that. So after I stopped smoking. And then I also, when I stopped smoking, I became so raggedy and, you know, just so, what's the word, you know, just naked, naked without the smoke screen, that I got a therapist. She, a woman, and she was so dear. She would cry when I cried. You know, she was there. So thank you, God, for her. And, yeah, I had to drop that addiction. So I went to AA, Nicotine Anonymous, and then I went to ACA and Debtors Anonymous, of course. I was a compulsive spender and debtor. I went to Love Addicts Anonymous. So I had all these anonymous groups go to, and some of my friends would say in AA, they would say, Beth, you don't need 48 steps. You just need 12 steps. And I would say, yeah, I do. You know, for me, I had to focus each of my issues. I had to focus and be with people with each of those issues to get that recovery. That's just how it was. And I was so fortunate where I got sober and in ACA recovery that all these meetings were available to me in Los Angeles. So, my daughter lives with the effects of alcoholism, and she married somebody just like her. He's an ACA. They've been married 17 years, and somehow, they're okay. I mean, they're not perfect. They got their stuff, but. What I do, they live in the Midwest. She met him at UCSB, so they moved to Illinois. They moved away from all their parents. That's what did it. You know, that was the big, wonderful thing they did for each other. No family lives around them. And so they only had each other, you know, to turn to, and they got very, they have a strong church parish. So, but what I do as living amends to my daughter, because I was an alcoholic mother, you know, she was 21 when I got sober. So what I do for living amends to her is that I go back there twice a year to Illinois, and they let me stay in their basement. And they have three little boys, my grandsons. Three little boys. Boys that I don't, you know, I don't know about boys. I'm scared of boys. So, but these little boys are my grandsons. And so it's been an interesting, it's just been wonderful. I mean, I love them so much. And we play like children. Because I have an inner child. I'll never give up that. You know, I have that inner child. So we play, and I'm in service to my daughter. And, you know, I get to not tell her how to do her life, which is really hard. But she has good boundaries. you know, she'll say, Mom, Mom, you're being really negative. I am? And I thought it was just being helpful. She's just really negative. So she's a, you know, she's got a different thing going than I had as a child. Mm-hmm. Who knows how you're going to turn out of these homes, right? You got a lot of different stuff going in you. Her dad, actually, she feels loved and valued by her dad. And she feels loved and valued by me. So that's a good deal. It's just that she was raised in a war zone. And it was really scary for her. So she has anxiety. So today, the way it is that I hang with safe people. You know, safe people. There's a lot of safe people around. I don't like to be around people, edgy people. And I know when I get edgy, because I'm an alcoholic. So I can get edgy, and I can get judgmental and controlling. You get all those things we get, you know. But I know when it's happening now. I actually know. It doesn't take too long. And I think, am I being the woman I want to be with? You know, no, I'm not being that woman. I'm being snarky and bossy. So it doesn't last too long. So we learned in that wonderful family of ACA that I started out in, they would bring their little shoes, by the way. Do you guys do that? They would bring their little kid's shoes if they had them. I don't know. One of the gals brought her little girl moccasins in. It was just so sweet. She loved those shoes so much. That was all she had of her to represent her child. So we learned there that we treat everyone with humor, gentleness, and respect. Everyone, no matter how they're treating us, because this is how we treat ourselves. So it's so simple, you know, the way to do this is so simple. Humor, gentleness, and respect. That goes, if I do it for myself, then it's going to come and go out, you know, whatever is in is without within. So I'm going to end with this cool story that maybe you guys have heard this, but it's this man fell in the hole, and it's not the whole story you think you know. It's not that one, Kelly. It's another one. This man fell in a hole, and he was helpless down there with dark and scary, and a banker came by and threw some money at him. He's still stuck in the hole. And then a clergy person came by and knelt down and prayed for him and quoted the Bible and then went on. He's still stuck in the hole. And a psychiatrist came. And the psychiatrist stayed a while. He says, tell me about your parents and about your childhood. So he told the psychiatrist. The psychiatrist had to leave after an hour. So that guy was still stuck in the hole. So then, you know who came by? One of us. He jumps right down into the hole. Yeah, because that's how we recover around here, right? He says, I know the way out. Thank you for letting me share.